Welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. I'm your host, Willem Vanderhorst. So, this is... I wonder why I'm just realizing. I usually say, I'm Willem Vanderhorst, your host for the show, and I switched it around because I was thinking, I think real TV hosts, real ones, not like me, say I'm your host's name. And that's what I was trying to say. I'm not used to saying it that way. And I'm sure I said it that way before. I've just realized host and Vanderhorst are almost the same word. Anyway, it's completely silly, but I'm your host, Willem Vanderhorst. Willem Vander, the host. Anyway, completely nothing to do with what we're talking about in this episode. So I had a fantastic conversation with Emma McKinley. Emma is a strategist, storyteller, and writer based out of Atlanta, Georgia. I located her while browsing through LinkedIn, as you know, what I do when I'm a little bit, I have a bit of free time for projects, and I'm both looking for guests and connecting with people in the wider strategy industry or creative industry. Or if I come across interesting sounding people, I'll look them up, look up what they wrote, or look at their website. And I thought that was the case with Emma, and I asked her if she'd be up for having a conversation, and she was. I'm not going to go over too much because we really talk about all this in the episode, but she's done a lot of different things. She's written a lot for a number of publications. She's done some public speaking, including events such as Pachacucha. And we talk about storytelling a lot. She usually refers to herself, and we begin the conversation there, as a griot, j'imagine, and it's a word coming out of West Africa and Senegal. I think it's Senegal, if I remember correctly. But we talk about that a little bit more. It's a storytelling tradition, essentially. So really, really great conversation. A lot of fantastic thoughts, stories of her childhood. As you know, if you listen to the podcast, you know that I like digging into those a little bit. And a lot of her views about creative communication strategy and marketing as well. So yeah, before we go there, just a little bit of housekeeping. Again, you're probably used to this unless this is the first time you listen. But I'm just going to keep repeating, because if you keep listening, I'm going to hope that at some point you take action. And the action that I'm asking you to take is, if you enjoy the podcast, then please, please, please leave a review and ideally a 5-star rating of the podcast on your favorite podcasting app. For a lot of people, that's going to be the iPhone native podcast app, Apple Podcasts on your iPhone. And that's also linked, if you're on your computer for any reason, that's linked to your iTunes account. So if you type in Ice Cream for Everyone on your computer, you can find it. You can give the show a 5-star review or whatever star you think, but ideally 5 stars. And a review just saying a little bit about what you think of the show, what it's about, what you appreciate. And it helps more people find the show. It helps me just keep motivated to keep producing episodes. And yeah, so it makes a difference. And or share it on social media. Share it on Twitter. Share it on Facebook. Share it with some of your friends. Send an email. Maybe there's one person in particular you think they'll enjoy this episode. And or send me a shout. Like just shout out. Just tell me on Twitter that you enjoy it. Or send me an email. So on Twitter, my Twitter handle is icvillem. Letters I-N-C-W-I-L-L-E-M. And my email is villem, W-I-L-L-E-M, at icecreamforeveryone.net. Ice Cream for Everyone is all spelled out, which is the same address URL as my website, icecreamforeveryone.net. You can go on there and find out a little bit more about the kind of stuff I do in terms of marketing strategy, branding, advertising, communications. If you are looking for help on that side of things for your business or for anything along the lines, or you have questions on how to do brand strategy or how to present your brand or how to sell whatever your products or services are or how to manage your communications, don't hesitate keeping in touch. I'm pretty busy at the moment, which is one of the reasons I'm scrambling a little bit, and it's been more than a week since my last episode, and I recorded this conversation a little bit, well, longer than I was hoping to publish it in. I mean, I always planned for a little bit of delay between recording and publishing, but this is a bit longer than originally expected. Anyway, but let's not dwell on that. We had a really fantastic conversation, and listening to it again, I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And without further ado, here's Emma. welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. Thanks very much. Good morning.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to the conversation. This is exciting.
Yeah,
so,
you too.
Sometimes I wonder if I repeat excited or not, but anyway, sometimes it's funny because being French, I can tend to be a little bit blasé in a slightly arrogant way. And okay. Sometimes I don't realize that. And but at the same time, I'm also have some American traits and, you know, I do get excited about things. So anyway, so before we start, so this is where I thought we'd start. And we exchanged some emails and some notes about what we were going to be talking about, which was fantastic. And there was a word I didn't know, and I had to look it up. And it's a very interesting word, and it seemed like a good place to start. Griot. So do you pronounce, is it a French word?
It probably is. I know it in the context of West Africa, but I'm sure that it has some French origin.
Apparently it did. And I was wondering, so can you tell us what it is? And how you pronounce it, griot?
Sure, yes, I call it griot.
Yeah.
Some people colloquially will call it a griot. So if you hear griot, don't judge, just translate to griot. But griot is basically it's a cast of people in West Africa that are the storytellers in community. They are the keeper of tradition. They are the keeper of, you know, stories and songs. And so that word, you know, as I've grown, has really, it really just describes me. It really describes my family. You know, griot is a person, you know, is from a band of storytellers. And that's my family. Growing up, us having a good time, or even today, is telling stories. Some families like to go bowling. Some families like to play instruments or watch TV. We tell stories. My parents talk about things that happened in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. When I was a little kid, my idea of a good time was not going outside, but it was sitting cross-legged on the floor in front of my granny and her brother and asking them to tell me stories about the 1920s and her prom. So griot is a storyteller. And so that is probably the word that best encapsulates who I am.
Awesome. That's fantastic. So that's the one word description. And then just for the slightly longer introduction about who you are and what you do, how would you describe that for everybody who doesn't know you?
Sure. So I am Amma McKinley. I am a freelance strategist. And let's see, I love to focus on things that have to do with the human condition. And anything that speaks to a sense of community or tribalism or just innate human traits. I love to be able to connect the threads from multicultures, from various cultures, and find the things that bind and unite us and that are similar to just basic and distinct to human across culture and across time. So that's how I would describe myself professionally, but we'll get into
the rest. Absolutely. No, this is great. And you're based in Atlanta, is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I am born and raised in Georgia, moved around quite a bit. And then I am, yes, back in Atlanta. This is home.
Cool. And as a strategist, I thought about this as a question. It's great that we start on the storytelling side of things. Storytelling is a very, well, I mean, it's quite used in the advertising, creative communications industry, right? Do you think
oh my God.
Yes. Do you think it's underrated or overrated as a word?
That's a really good question. And I'm biased and probably have some very strong feelings about this. So I think that it is very used, but I think that it is perhaps underrated. And perhaps underrated in the sense of quality or passion of storytelling. So humans, we are innately storytellers. We gather around, we would gather around fires and tell stories and look at the stars and create stories and watch the wind blow and create stories. So that's who we are, just as a species. We are storytellers, and this is how we pass our traditions from generation to generation. But I think it's underrated in the sense of the quality of the stories that are told through communications. It's become more about just putting out content as opposed to, you know, going into the depth of stories. I think you have a few brands and agencies that are brave in the stories that they're willing to tell. But I think it's underrated because as a industry, I don't think that we're very aware of the power that we have, especially when we're able to tell brave stories or dig deeper into, again, like the truths that are across culture or the truths that are across time. I think, and I've seen this working with clients, that sometimes just the safe bet of the story is we're authentic. We keep it real. And there's no bravery. There's no substance in the story, and the story fades. It's not a story that is carried from, you know, from person to person or generation to generation. So I think that it's underrated in the sense of that there's not enough bravery when it comes to storytelling and knowing the power of a good story.
Yeah. Thank you. And do you think it's interesting? One thing I was just wanting to check in some of what you were just saying, which is great. When you say we have the power to tell great stories, I think I'm not exactly quoting you, but I was just wondering, who was the we? Did you mean we in general, human beings, or in particular within the creative industry, some group of people?
I'm speaking especially within the creative industry.
And did you think people, agency, on the strategy agency side, clients, everyone?
Yes, on the strategy side, on the agencies and client side. So I think that innately strategists, planners, like we love to dig and look for the aha moments and look for the truth of who people and things are. Like that is our gift to the world. That is our profession. But I think that when it comes to how does that translate, you know, I love what creatives are able to do. And of course, it is a very sacred craft. But I think that there's got to be bravery on the side of clients, or maybe even what we present to clients as the strategists, as the creatives, to be able to say, like, we know the safe bet. Perhaps let's go a layer deeper. No, everything isn't going to be, you know, if you're selling, you know, selling shoe polish, it doesn't have to be something about, you know, we're saving the human condition. But if there's a way that we can be even a little bit more authentic, a little bit more brave, to be able to tell a story that matters, and matters in the sense of, you know, lasting or connection. I think that that's really the word, is that, you know, when we are in this industry and creative or communications, we're trying to connect. A message isn't received, or is not a successful message, if it's not received on the other end, or if it's easily forgotten. So I think that if we can communicate in a way that begets some longevity, sincerity is a part of that. And if we're just willing to go a little deeper and say, why is this going to matter? And will it matter in a month? Will it matter in a year? Then the quality of the stories that we tell, they will be stronger because we've spoken in the instance of longevity, the truth that is long living, rather than something that's just to fill a content hole on a content calendar.
Yeah, that's great. And so overused but underrated at the same time.
Yes.
And particularly in working for brands, creative communications, marketing and advertising, I agree with you on everything that's going on the story side. But I also tend to think that it's not, maybe because it's overused, we tend to think we need to tell a story, but sometimes it's not always needed to achieve whatever challenge we have to sell more of the things that we want to sell. What do you think of that? Do you agree? Or do you think that storytelling has a particular role in some kinds of challenges or communications? Or
that is a really good question. Or? And I feel like you're being a really good devil's advocate right now, like challenging the griot.
Possibly. But it's open. I'm not trying to trap you or anything.
That's really good. That's really good. And The Devil's Advocate was a really good movie. Let me see.
It was a while ago.
It was, but I think again, that's a, you know, bringing this into conversation, that's a story that's lasting. It was something, but okay, I won't get too woo-woo and philosophical. Bring it back. Does everything need a story?
Well, we will go woo-woo and philosophical, I hope. if we manage.
Stay tuned. We're only a few minutes in. let's see. So does everything need a story? I think that I'm going to say yes. And I think that the story is in the skill of the storyteller. So if I'm selling shoe polish, it could be about, you know, the communication could be about its benefits and its value proposition. And that's not a story per se, but it could be Bob's going on a date. Bob doesn't want dry shoes. Bob's going to, like, that is a story, but it's the quality. It's just ill. And so there's still so many ways that you can tell a story using that product that talks about sentiment. And that's when, like, the power of, like, the creatives come in, because they can find something that's lasting and they can find something that's true that is going to last longer and speak longer than a value proposition or, you know, a hunky dunk story about Bob. Yes, I think that everything can be a story, but it's in the value of the story that you tell. It doesn't mean that it has to be something epic like the Titanic, but Yes, I believe that all communication, when done well, does beget storytelling, almost in the way that I believe that prayer is poetry or poetry is prayer, like Rumi is in that category, or Khalil Gibran. You know, I think that they can be both when done very well.
Right. Cool. Well, I think let's dig in a little bit more, and I wanted to go back. So hopefully a good segue. I like if I managed to do good segues on the fly, which is not that often, but let's dig in into, like, what kinds of stories do you like? And going back to you being a child in Georgia and sitting in to ask stories of your grandmother or grandfather or both?
My granny and her brother. They were my first and favorite storytellers.
Awesome. So what did you love the most about their stories? How was it?
I think that, like, for being a child, you know, where you have to sit on the ground cross-legged and you have to really strain your neck up to look up as high as you can because you're so little and they're so big and so old sitting in a chair. Like, even just the theater of the moment, I remember just the strain in the front of my neck to be able to hear and to pay attention. But also, like, being a child and trying to imagine a time that I was not there. So I was 6 and my entire world was around me. There was no thought of politics or, you know, taxes or student loans or even vacation. Like, that was not in the mind of a 6-year-old. So then to be opened up to a world, not just outside of our house, but before the house was there, was just baffling to me. So, you know, to think of the time my granny was born in 1913, how is that possible? Oh my goodness.
Wow.
And I will always remember, you know, I would think that was amazing because she was born, you know, around the time that the Titanic sank. And that was just huge to me because I remember learning about it in school or having some kind of pop-up book. And I think that that was probably the oldest thing that I could, like, pinpoint in my small 6-year-old brain was, oh, that was so long ago. It was around the Titanic. So I love that they were able to create a world for me. And I think that I would have to credit her and my uncle, her brother, with creating a sense of the past. I think that they were the ones that introduced history to me because it was before me and it was real and they could talk about these things if they remember. And I did that with my granny and my uncle until they passed away. And I continue to do that with my parents, with my godmother, who's 88 years old. Anytime that I can get a sense of history through someone else's eyes and through their autobiography, I think that's what I love about just the person-to-person storytelling.
Thank you. Do you have siblings?
Yes, I do.
Yeah?
Did they
spend time with you? Sorry.
Go ahead. I am the youngest of 4.
You're the youngest of 4. Oh, cool. Boys, girls, there's 4 of us in my family, and the last one's a girl. There's 3 boys, then the last one's a girl.
Bless her. So, no, all girls. I am youngest of four very loved and spoiled girls.
Fantastic. And how did you, so a lot of storytelling with your grandma, your granny, and how was it growing up? What kind of environments you grew up in? Because number one, I'm interested in the question, but I also don't know anything about the South. I was just listening to a podcast episode of Love Plus Radio yesterday, and it was all about Richmond, Virginia, and I realized I really don't know. I mean, it's not Georgia, but I don't know anything about the South in general is what I was realizing, basically.
That's so interesting, because I feel like your question is, you know, regarding the South is almost like asking a fish to tell you about water.
Probably.
that's really interesting. So I'll try to answer that through my experience. So born and raised in Augusta, Georgia, right outside of Augusta, Georgia, which is the home of the Masters Golf Tournament.
Is that kind of a suburban area? Or
yes, rural. So I was Augusta is a small town. I mean, it's growing, but it's still very small town vibe. And then I grew up in a rural area outside of Augusta. And so, you know, deer and rabbits and raccoons in the backyard and people riding horses down the street in front of our house. For a senior prank in high school, there were three guys that drove their John Deere tractors to school, and we just thought that was the coolest thing. Like, that's how
okay
country. That is how country.
Usually, John Deere tractors I would associate with the countryside more than suburbia.
Yes, we definitely were a little. We were definitely some distance past suburbia. We had to drive through suburbia to get into town.
Got it.
When my parents built the house out there about 25 years ago, it was definitely very rural. We, you know, spent a lot of time together as a family. We did a lot of family vacations, a lot of road trips. And so that was just always full of laughing. We're all jokesters. We especially get it from my dad. And, you know, my cousins would ride with us. My aunt would ride with us. I mean, we'd have one of those, you know, old school vans from like the 80s or 90s and be packed to the brim with kids. And, you know, we would just go on vacations all over the South, or we would drive up to Chicago, which is where my parents are from and my grandparents are from.
Okay.
And then by the time my sisters went to college, we used to make a lot of road trips to their universities, especially during homecoming. And I mean, I feel like we were always traveling somewhere. And then my sisters are much older than I. So by the time they went to college, I was still in elementary and middle school. And then so my parents, still the travelers that they were, I got the luck of the draw where when they decided they were going on vacation, I got to go too, but now they weren't toting a whole bunch of kids. So the vacations got a little bit more upper echelon.
Yeah, a bit more exotic further.
Yes, they did. So my sisters are hilarious because they're still a little bitter about that one, but that's when the travel really started to expand for me and I got to get beyond, beyond the South.
Cool. And so how did you start, or when did you start, when did writing become a thing? Did reading become a thing first for you, writing, or?
That's a really good question. That's reflective. I cannot remember which came first, but I do know that I had a volume of Babysitter's Club and Nancy Drew books in my bedroom, and I used to tear through them. So they weren't just decor. I used to go through them.
And that's your how old approximately?
Reading Nancy Drew and Babysitter's Club? I probably still had my pink and purple canopy with the ruffles. So I was probably in fourth or fifth grade.
All right.
Oh man, you're making me dig into my own archives. This is fun.
good. I'm glad it's fun.
Oh yeah, this is good. And then, so I know I definitely got my first diary in fifth grade, and I have kept a journal ever since then. So that was over 20 years ago, and I've been writing and journaling for over 20 years now. That was my very first one. And from Dear Diary to journaling, then got into poetry, and then I used to really keep a big record of quotes, and then I started writing short stories, especially fiction. I started writing fiction. And then I really got into reading autobiographies. And so I started writing memoirs, and then started blogging and publishing.
How did you start reading biographies? Like, how did that become an interest?
I think that, and just to reflect in this, even a sense of this conversation, like I got so much from autobiographies because the drama of a real life to me is always so exciting, more so than fiction, because it's so, autobiographies are so good that you don't have to make it up. Well, and okay. So I think I started reading autobiographies in college or grad school. And so now, like, I struggle reading fiction. I love autobiographies and just nonfiction in general. It's really challenging for me to dive into fiction, but I really get a hit off of diving into the history of a person's real life.
Wow, this is great, because I guess I don't know if there's such a thing as an opposite to that, but I was always attracted to fantasy and science fiction. Mm-hmm, and that's a large part of what I read all the time. Mm-hmm. I've read a few biographies, but not many, definitely nothing historic. And these days, most of my reading diet is fantasy, science fiction, and nonfiction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which I really appreciate and respect. I've been having a conversation for a couple of weeks with a good friend of mine, and you know, the show on Starz, American Gods, and the show was really great. And he's like, "Oh, well, the book is better." And I'm like, "I don't know if I can read it."
I love Neil Gaiman so much. He's one of my favorite all time authors.
I'm going to try it. It's a try. It's an effort to see, like, can I do this? Let's see. I haven't read any of the Game of Thrones books, but I am a rabid fan of the show and will be watching the premiere for the final season. But you know, these great American like films and shows, like I'm so into, like Handmaid's Tale. I love the show, but I'm afraid to read the book. So.
Do you have any all-time favorite autobiographies or biographies that you'd recommend?
So anything by Maya Angelou. I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings is you know, like one of her, you know, most premier works, the one she's most famous for. But she has books that follow that are just as she started to grow and become a woman and become a mother, and like those kind of coming of age stories, it really just adds even more sparkle to just the huge figure that she is. So I love just the books about, you know, her real life. And then more recently, last year, I read Trevor Noah's Born a Crime.
And it's been on my radar.
It is so good. And I recommend the audiobook. So again, Griot is the story of like the art of the spoken word. For his book, it's so amazing because he's just a great conversationalist and a storyteller anyways. Excuse me.
So he's reading his own book then, right?
He's reading his own book.
Oh, that's cool.
And then so there are times in the story when he switches languages to Zulu or to Xhosa, and he will begin to speak in that language as he's telling the story. And so it's this multilingual tapestry. And if you were reading the book, then you would not be able to hear the inflection that you know, sometimes you hear a person speaking another language, you don't know what they're saying, but you get it.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, we translate inflection and emotion. So you hear that when he tells the story. And I absolutely love that. It was a very rare and valuable feature of his book that I don't get from a lot of books.
Oh, that's cool. So that's both encouraging me to try audiobooks that I don't usually, that I don't listen to at all.
And you got to try it.
All right, cool. I will.
Let his be your first one, just because it was just excellent grade A storytelling for sure.
But you know what? I will actually return, but I won't give as vivid a recommendation because I haven't listened to it because I don't, okay. as I said, I don't listen to audiobooks. But I have heard from Tim Ferriss and others who rave about Neil Gaiman's The Graveyard Book in audiobook because he reads it and he does have a fantastic voice.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be worth trying the fiction. And it's a much shorter book than American Gods, and it's a fantastic book as well. It's really beautiful.
I am going to try it. I've got an Audible credit waiting on me, and so it is now stamped with your approval. Thank you, good sir.
Brilliant. All right, so let's see. So we just touched on travel. I was wondering, the interest on travel seems like it started with traveling with your parents, and then you went off to study marketing, but I don't know which order things, I mean, there's different topics, obviously, but
sure.
Where did the interest in choosing to go study marketing, where did that come in? How did that come in?
Sure. So I decided to study marketing in college, or I decided to choose that major in college probably when I was about eighth or ninth grade. And again, if you haven't caught the theme, everything is a story with me. So I was watching the movie What Women Want with my dad in the living room of our house, sitting on the floor, absolutely loved it with Mel Gibson and Helen Hunt. And I was fascinated by what he was doing. And I said, Dad, how can I do that? What do I need to, you know, study so that I can do that? And he said, marketing. And that was it for me. That was the gospel.
For anybody who doesn't remember, I think he's an advertising exec or something in an ad agency movie, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. He's an advertising exec in an agency, super chauvinistic, and he gets struck by lightning. And I mean, spoiler alerts, if you haven't seen it by now, I mean,
I think that's okay.
Right. I'm just, yeah.
But spoiler alerts.
It's like 20 years late. But yeah, he's able to hear the voices of the thoughts of women, excuse me. And so now he's like, has deep dived into learning about like the emotions and thoughts and concerns of the women that he was taking advantage of, or the people he was taking advantage of. And like, I watched that movie again earlier this year, and I was like, he was doing so much. Like, he was an exec. So he was an account manager. But like, when he's going out and like listening to thoughts, he's a planner. He's immersed in people and trying to understand, oh, and he's a creative, he's making the ads. Like, it was not accurate whatsoever. But for me as a child, it was basically, I got to see the parts that come into making good work in advertising. However, I will say that I did not know until much later in my life that people go to school for advertising.
Yeah.
And so if you grow up in small town USA and you don't know anybody in this industry, you don't have educational institutions around or have a knowledge of these educational institutions, then if you happen to be sparked by the interest, then you get there any way you can. So for me, it was marketing. I didn't know that, you know, that there were advertising programs. And so when we talk about, you know, in the industry, things like pipeline, it's not just getting more people into advertising majors or getting them to go to portfolio schools. I think it's also, you know, going into other majors, you know, and other fields of study to see where people have skills and education that's applicable into this industry. And so I was a result of that. I had no clue I wanted to be in this industry a very long time ago, and got here through my own ball of yarn, curvaceous way.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was how I ended up majoring in marketing. And so I went to undergrad, majored in marketing, did internships within different facets of marketing. And then
internships in different countries as well, right?
Yes, I did. So my very first internship was in Seville, Spain.
How did that come about? Was it?
we had an exchange student in one of my high school classes, and I promised her that I was going to come to Spain the summer after my sophomore year of college. And so that's just how it worked. I ended up finding this program. I was a huge Spanish nerd. When I was in high school, I used to read my dictionary for fun and conjugate my Spanish verbs for fun.
Wow.
I was such a nerd. It was great. And
okay.
So yeah, just found the program and I wanted to work in advertising. And so I ended up working for a small creative shop in Seville, Spain. And I ended up, I had to create my own project. And so I created a project there about the multicultural groups of Southern Spain. So again, I was doing, you know, consumer research and even then, and just trying to learn, like, who are these people and what interests them. And I noticed that there were no multicultural ad campaigns at the time in Spain or in Southern Spain. And so that was what my research was geared towards, was, you know, identifying these groups and learning about them and buying power and such. So that was my first internship. The second one, I was at HBO in Manhattan, working affiliate marketing.
Sorry, I'll stop you for a second before you go there.
Sure, sure.
A recommendation, because you're making me think about it and it's right on my shelf and I'm looking at it. Have you heard of an author called Jason Webster?
Maybe
not. He's not very famous. But I really, really love him. He's a British man who's been living in Spain for a very, very long time. Mm. And talking about Southern Spain, I mean, he's written, his first book is called Duende, and it's all about flamenco culture. His second or third, I can't remember, is called Andalus. And in this, both a travel and exploration book. He picks up and meets a young Moroccan who's picking fruit in Southern Spain and Andalusia, because a lot of that, they grow fruit for the rest of Europe. And they go wandering around all of Southern Spain looking for the remnants of Arabic and the Moorish culture that was there for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And how it's still there or not there. And so it's both a travel and exploration and multicultural book, and it's fantastically written.
This is nonfiction.
Yeah, nonfiction.
Oh,
travel books is also my own. I have a lot of travel books.
Okay. So this is very exciting to me, because when I was in Spain, I lived in Andalusia and did travel all over Andalusia and did get to see the Moorish remnants, and then went to Morocco and was a super quick, like 3-4 day, like venture through Morocco from the Strait of Gibraltar all the way down to Fez. And it was super fast and it was amazing. So I absolutely, what that book is talking about, I've been to several of those places, the Alhambra, which is amazing.
Oh, I still haven't been, actually, I'm embarrassed to say. But I have been to Seville. That was when I was dancing flamenco for a short while, and I have the proper shoes that I still haven't used in ages.
Impressive. Do you have the pants? Because I think that men in flamenco pants are a service to humanity.
Are they? No, I don't have the pants. I don't know that I could wear them. Maybe I'll pick up lessons again. It's been a while, and I only took lessons for a couple of years. My older brother got married in Andalusia. Awesome. My grandfather's from Andalusia. Well, Catalonia.
Nice.
In Andalusia.
And, so you are French and American, and you dance flamenco.
And Dutch and Spanish.
So
technically,
my
grandparents on my mom's side is Spanish, my dad's side is Dutch, but I was born in the States and raised in France.
I would give you a high five right now if this wasn't digital.
You do audio podcast high five.
I know. I love it. Oh, high five in the mic. So my remember when I was going to Spain, my mom just really, you know, at that time she was just like, people are people no matter where you go. And so like that was her repetitive charge. And so being in Spain was my first time out of the country by myself. I was very young and was a sponge. And so I loved being able to learn people, even if I did not, you know, understand everything they said. And to be all over Spain, and to go to Portugal, to be able to go to Morocco, it was so eye-opening for me. And then eventually, you know, spending time in New York, which is its own lab, and then spending time in Mozambique, which was amazing. And so that has been the charge for me, kind of just at the onset for me, how I approach storytelling and how I approach culture and how I approach strategy, is just that people are people no matter where you go. And so I look for the string that binds us wherever I go and whatever my work is.
Awesome. Fantastic. And do you, so in, you know, from the point of seeing Mel Gibson in the movie to studying marketing, to finding out more about it, to doing some internships, along the way, you must have found out more, I mean, I'm guessing, about strategy, or did you like make up a plan? Like, what is it that you focus on now? How do you?
So it took a while for me to learn about strategy, and I did different things in marketing and social media, and I even did recruiting for a while and content strategy, and then focused more so on the writing and blogging and speaking and speaking at conferences and events. And but it wasn't until maybe 2016, early 2017, that strategy landed in my lap. And I'll say it literally landed. I was just frustrated with the professional prospects and was speaking with a mentor of mine. And he said, just tell me, explain to me what it is that you want to do. And I told him, he's like, oh, that is a profession. It is called planning or strategy.
How did you describe what you wanted to do?
I do not remember.
How do you describe what you wanted to do?
I don't remember how I described it back then, but it was probably like, I don't know. I was probably possessed by a muse, and the muse spoke. I have no idea what it is that I said, but I'm sure it was probably something along the lines of like identifying truths, understanding people, and being able to help clients solve business problems. That's probably what I said, or if it wasn't, that's what I would
something
say.
In that's
how
regard,
I would define
yeah.
it now. Yes. And he told me about planning, and that was it. I took off. And so, yeah, that must have been early 2017. The Portfolio Center here in Atlanta, or Miami Ad School at Portfolio Center, was having their first strategy boot camp starting that fall. And so I was a part of the first class. So advertising is a career change for me. Mm. Yeah, being able to bring in everything, all the experience that I have, all the education, all of the travel, you know, my very first weekend in boot camp, when I was just, you know, going through, you know, detailing for our instructors, Archana and RP Kumar, just talking about just the work that I've done. It was so validating from them to be so experienced in the field and say, like, the best planners have the most experiences. Mm. Planning isn't something that you read out of a book. It's, you know, you need to bring in your understanding of the world in it. And I've seen a lot, and I plan on seeing a lot more. And so because my career has not been linear, I didn't gel with any industry or company that was looking for a linear resume.
Yeah.
And planning is the one place that says, you know, everything that I bring to the table is needed and very valuable, that divergent people belong here. And so this is absolutely what I was meant to do. This is my true vocation.
That's fantastic. That's great to hear.
And thank you.
It is. And I had the same kind of experience, and I don't have a linear career at all, which is also, I think, why I really enjoy talking to people who have very varied experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Did you recommend, because I'd also never really formally studied this either. Although, I mean, through books and conversations, and then on practicing on the job more than anything. Do you recommend those kinds of boot camps? One, and we talked a little bit about the fact that there are now advertising programs and this kind of boot camp and or more formal strategy courses. And at the same time, it's valuable to have world experiences in different areas. So you could see those things as contradictory. So I don't know. I was interested in having any of your comments on how that program was at first thing, and then the second on just any thoughts you have for people who are either looking to go in that kind of career, how to take the fact that, you know, both the world experience and some kind of training are useful.
Sure. So I would recommend the boot camp, a boot camp, if you're
interested. How long
interested
is it? Sorry, how long is the boot camp?
It was 10 or 12 weeks. It was really rapid fire.
All right.
And so I would recommend it to anyone, you know, to an experienced professional who is interested in making the change to strategy. I think that if you come into the boot camp right after school, that it may be challenging, especially if you haven't had, you know, any internships in planning or been exposed to planning in any way, just because it can then be a bit of a challenge. I've seen for someone to be able to get a full-time role afterwards or to get an internship, it can be challenging to get started if you don't have any other professional experience. I mean, yes, there are junior roles out there. Yes, there are internships. But there were a lot of people in my class who were professionally experienced before coming into strategy. Mm-hmm. And I've just seen it be able to help create like just a grounding to be able to pull from experiences, whether you've done client side work or whether you've, been a professionally trained ballet dancer, as one of my classmates was in boot camp. He danced professionally around the world for 10 years before he decided that he wanted to try planning. And so, yeah, having some kind of basis of relevancy or reference, excuse me, I think is really important. But it's valuable because I'd been trying to get the attention of people in the industry before that and could not get a hit. But after that, it immediately kind of, there's so many alumni or people who have been through the boot camp, and so they immediately know the quality, and they're of all levels of title within their agencies or whether they're freelancing. And so it puts you in a group of people who get it, and it really shows people that you're hungry. And so I can't speak more about it because I wouldn't have been able to make inroads into the industry without taking that step, because it let the industry know how serious I was.
Yeah. No, this is great. All right, cool. Changing topics and just wanting to move on to another thing before we wrap up, sure. Which is being a little bit conscious of time. There's another point we said we were going to talk about, and I was very curious. 2 points on your Instagram profile, just one word mentions diviner. And on another website that you're an initiated priestess and spiritual consultant of the, I don't know how it's pronounced, Ifa Lukumi faith. Is that right?
Yes, and you did very well with your pronunciation. You did.
So yeah, I was very curious to hear about all of that world, whatever sure, that sure. is, because so, I don't know about that faith much.
I'm gonna give you a quick 101. Awesome. Don't worry. Thank you. So I'm actually, I really appreciate you for sharing that or bringing that up to my attention and asking me. And it's usually something that, I've got it on my Instagram, I've got it here, but I have yet to bring that part of me into my professional sphere, but the truth of the matter is that for me, they are the same. They belong in the same circle. And so this is me like letting those two worlds of mine hug each other and be best friends. So there is a tradition that comes out of West Africa, and specifically around Nigeria, a spiritual tradition. That is called Ifa, I-F-A. And so brief history is that when the people were taken from Africa and brought to the West, they had their own cultures and customs that they brought with them. And at risk of persecution, they were told to convert or die. Many of them were clever in that they were able to take Catholic emblems and be able to say, fill them with their sacred implements or objects so that they could still keep the traditions and beliefs of their homeland alive. And so Ifa or Lukumi, as it's called in Cuba and Puerto Rico, or Umbanda or Candomblé, as it's called in Brazil and Uruguay and Mexico, the traditions of these people are very much alive. And so what's been happening in the last, especially 10, 15, 20 years, is that there's been a huge kind of like
revival,
new string resurgence. Of resurgence, we'll call it that. there's just been a huge just drawing for people of African descent in the U.S. to begin to learn more about the historical context of these spiritual practices. And so there's, you know, pop references where, you know, people are talking about Beyonce's Lemonade video or Lemonade Corpus and some of her, you know, performances are bringing in a lot of Orisha reliefs. Orisha are like the divinities of the practice. So I guess I will, before I go too far into a tangent and lose people, the point is that this is a spiritual practice that I study. Yeah. From its anthropological standpoint and from its historical standpoint, and from the spiritual standpoint to me as well. And it helps to ground me, even, you know, going back to the beginning of the conversation, being able to find the common themes and threads throughout humanity and throughout time. You know, in school, we all studied the pantheon of the Greek and Roman gods. And I find that as I have studied indigenous spiritual practices, you know, from Africa or from South America, that they all happen to have divinities that worship the same things, whether it's, you know, motherhood or the family or the river. And so I'm like, okay, so these are things that are innately human and special to all of humankind. And it's just interesting to be able to look at the world through the lens of, you know, to find relevancy in today's world through a lens of ancient spirituality. And it really helps to connect me with other people and especially other cultures, because I can look through this lens of empathy. Even recently, I gave a lecture that talked about the relationship or the similarities, excuse me, between ancient intelligence and artificial intelligence. And because artificial intelligence can, you know, really scare people, especially when we talk about deep fakes and Her, the movie. And sometimes ancient intelligence just seems too far or irrelevant. And so being able to find the similarities between those two and was able to present those ideas to my peers.
That sounds awesome.
So it's I appreciate that. And it's just, again, it's just something that I really anchor kind of just my understanding of culture and people. It gives me a lot of grace and empathy for people and really just gives me a sense of like of connection beyond, you know, just having a dogma. It's not just like a religious dogma, yeah. But it's really about how are these things interconnected and the fact that I'm able to bring that thinking into my work to help talk about artificial intelligence, like, or any sort of challenges or new innovations, it puts continued life.
Fantastic.
Into the ancient. Mm-hmm. Almost like American gods.
I was just going to say, actually, I have two quick questions to follow up because American gods, and Neil Gaiman really likes them because he's put them in two books. So is Anansi, the spider god from Africa, part of the pantheon that we're talking about?
No, but very tradition? Good, very good recall. Different tradition. Okay. Anansi is from Ghana, and their spiritual system is called Akan, A-K-A-N.
Okay, cool.
And so Anansi is the storyteller god of indigenous Ghana.
Got it. And is that talk that you mentioned about ancient and artificial intelligence, is the presentation online or anywhere, just so I know for the show notes, or...?
No, it is not online. It was something that I gave closed door at my last agency. I wish that I had it available.
Okay. All right. Well, no problem. There'll be.
I just have a separate essay of it. I did write it up as an essay for my portfolio.
Are you still writing and publishing these days?
I have not in quite some time. I took a hiatus, but I will be. It's... writing has helped me to process through different life stages and challenges. And so now I'm in the space of collecting new experiences. It's almost like after your favorite artist writes an album after they go through a divorce and then you don't hear them for a while. they have to get new stories. They have to get new grounding. And so writing in the creative sense, writing memoirs is absolutely who I am. But right now I'm gathering new joy, and we'll be able to write about those in short time.
Very cool. All right. Well, I think it's about time we start wrapping up, and usually finish with some cool down questions. And just to get us into the mood of it, it's still the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. So do you have a favorite ice cream flavor?
Ooh. My inner fat kid just got ravenous. So I'm going to give you two. Right. There, it is banana pudding ice cream by Bluebell.
Oh, wow, I haven't had that as an ice cream. That sounds very good.
It has the actual vanilla wafers in it.
All right. And is Bluebell a local kind of like parlor or regional ice cream maker? I'll check them out because I didn't know the brand. Well, I don't know the brand.
Sure. Bluebell started in Texas, actually. And I know that they've like creeped further into the South. But I don't know where else they are because, you know, I'm a fish in my own bowl. But Bluebell. And then Talenti, their sorbets, like they've got a raspberry sorbet that is...
That is very good. I've had that. It's very good. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Like, it's so rich. Like, I'd never get a bowl of Talenti. I literally will go and get a few spoonfuls of it right out of the freezer and then put it back. Like, I can't buy it. Like, I don't have the discipline anymore. It's so good.
Awesome. I usually also have an interest in playing games. I was wondering if you play any games, if there's a game that you enjoy and would recommend others play.
Oh.
It could be video, so it could be board games, card games, anything or not, if that's not really relevant.
So there's a game that I play on my phone, and I think it's called 2365.
Is that a numbers puzzle?
It is a numbers puzzle.
Is that the one where you have to add numbers together or something in squares?
Yes, it's basically... So the board is squares, but it's really like a game of like, you know, two square, two cube, two, like to the fourth. And so you have to shift them around the board, and it two becomes four, becomes eight, becomes 16, becomes 32, becomes 64, becomes 128. Yeah. Oh my God.
I played that a little bit a couple years ago. I'm pretty sure it's the same thing. It was driving me crazy. And I'm not very good at it.
It drives me crazy. I really like that game. And then there's one more that I used to play on my phone. I think it was called Alchemy. And it was such a funny little game. And it wasn't even the best design game. But they had like little icons of different elements. And you would drag the elements together to see what you could create. And so like, if you know, they might have a hydrogen atom and an oxygen, and then you put them together and you've got water, and then you get two waters together and now it makes an ocean. And then you put like, you just, it's, I think it was called Alchemy. Oh, but that was a good one. I want to find it. It drives me crazy. Cause like there's innumerable like combinations of things that you can create. And you get really surprised by like somehow you go from H2O to a robot and you're like, wait, what? It's a silly little game. Yeah, I used to play that years ago.
Another question I started asking, and I'm particularly interested in you as a writer, do you take notes? And if yes, like how do you take notes? What do you use? What kind of notebook do you use?
That's a really good question. So for me, like sometimes if I'm writing, like if it was a new article, a new blog article or you know, memoir piece that I would come up with, sometimes I would just get one line to pop in my head, or I would hear it and then I would just jot it down on my phone. So it's in the cloud. I can get it from my laptop or my phone.
What app do you use for that?
I just use Notes. I don't even, I've seen a lot of people use Evernote, but my Notes app on my iPhone is connected to my Notes app on my computer. And so I can just, it's right there on the cloud and just simple and write a line. And like sometimes the lines will accumulate over time. And then I'll just sit down and write and write and write and comb and comb. And I know that a piece is done when I can read through it 5 or 10 times and I don't have any edits. It can be really, really tedious. And then even if I am if I'm creating a lecture or like a spoken word piece, that also starts with the writing, as opposed to, you know, some people, like if I'm, it's so interesting because now I'm processing myself. Yeah, I have to write it out as a speech. Yeah. And to write it out as a speech, I have to speak it, and then I write it, and then I edit it, and then I cut it into pieces, and then put the images with it.
On that note, just because I'm thinking about it as a quick recommendation, I don't know if you read or anybody listening, some people listening will have read the Wait But Why, Tim Urban's blog and website. He wrote a fantastically long piece about, I mean, he only writes long pieces in general. I love his blog. And that one is about how he prepared for his TED talk. So there's a one whole part about procrastination, because that's what his TED talk is about. But there's a whole other part on where he distinguishes and puts aside the different ways in which, like he distinguishes, I guess, levels of readiness for a spoken speech and lecture. And I've seen this kind of thing elsewhere as well, like from, you know, speaking off the cuff completely to having bullet points and notes and speaking from them, to writing it but not owning what you've written yet, so you're not, it doesn't sound like you're the author even though you wrote it, to like assimilating so much that you've written every single word and you've practiced so much that it's a performance.
Yes, so I'm gonna check that out, because for me it's the latter. And eventually when I do my presentations, it is Pachakachar really helped to ground this for me, but I don't like to put bullet points on my presentations. There will be one central image and the story is spun around that image, and then that image is burned into the mind. But I don't do bullet points. I don't like to include a lot of quotes or text. Very minimal, very visual. And then it becomes
as much as possible, I'd like to do the same thing as well. All right. What's the last piece or a recent piece of art or media that had an impact on you?
Ooh. Oh, that is a hard question. Okay. Last piece of art or media? And we live in a digital age. My stars. Okay. So I don't know why this is coming to mind, but I was flipping through Facebook and I saw someone had drawn, it was just on a simple sheet of paper. She had drawn a woman with a dress, but then did a cutout of the dress. So it was just like the cutout of the silhouette, and then held it against flower bushes. And then so you would look through the paper and it was in the shape of a dress, but it looked like the print because it was a flower. And it was just like micro quick shots of that. And it was absolutely beautiful to me. I'm like, who would think to make a paper cutout and now you've got to look through it? And it was beautiful to me. And it was just,
that's great. All right, cool. We'll find a link and add that to the show notes. Yeah, it sounds beautiful, so beautiful, but I can really picture it, you describing it. So that's cool.
You've got to find it, because I'm just like, people are so creative and do such good things with their time, I swear.
All right, one last one. If you could give one thing to everyone, like you make a wish and everyone has that thing, what might it be?
Oh, grace. I would give everyone grace. I would give everyone the gift of grace. So that they could give grace to other people. Just the pause of awareness and kindness. And that's not woo-woo, but I think that grace in and of itself, like that's why the Southern folks say amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
I think that's a beautiful thought to finish on. And I hope people get a bit of grace listening to this. I think I certainly have out of the conversation.
Well, hallelujah.
Okay. So where can people find you online if they're looking up for you, if they need any strategy, advice, or like that?
Sure, absolutely. So the best way to contact me is on LinkedIn these days. I'll make sure that you get that link. And let's see. Yeah, LinkedIn is the best way because, you know, I'm definitely there communicating with people, you know, have information to share, my portfolio to share, My Instagram is private these days. But if you want to be friends on Instagram, just send me a note and we can be friends. But yes, yeah, so open to connecting with people. Always love a phone call. I love coffee.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time, Emma. Have a fantastic day, night. It's the morning here, but I don't know what time it is for people listening. And
it is the morning here too. I think we're both on the East Coast today. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you reaching out, and this was a lot of fun.
All right, that's another episode wrapping up. Thank you so much for listening all the way to this point. And if you did listen all the way to this point, I hope you enjoyed it. And as I said at the beginning, if you did enjoy it, it'd be awesome if you just share it with a friend. Tell more people. I just want more people to be listening to the podcast. And ideally, if you can, just give the show a rating and a review. It helps other people find the podcast on whatever algorithmic magic all the podcatchers are working on. And sharing it obviously lets your friends and your community know about it, and it encourages me to keep going with it. And if you tell me you're enjoying it, I know that there's some people out there that for whom it matters and it makes a difference, you know? If you give me a shout, you tell me on Twitter, is hugely appreciated when you take a few seconds or a couple of minutes to do that. I think that's about it for now. So yeah, thank you very much. I'll be back with another episode very soon. Have a fantastic morning, evening, afternoon, night, whatever time of day or night it is for you. All right, bye.